Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the landslide presidential election of the billionaire chocolate king Petro Poroshenko in Ukraine and the European Parliament elections that produced an alarming influx of far-right representatives from 28 European countries, in particular Britain, Denmark, France and Greece. Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council and is now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, joins us to assess Poroshenko's military offensive against armed secessionists in eastern Ukraine, and the new crop of xenophobes and racists with a sprinkling of neo-Nazis who were just elected across Europe. Then we'll look into Tuesday's 4-1 vote by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to kill further study of moving dangerously radioactive spent fuel from cooling pools at nuclear power plants to safer dry casks. An internationally recognized expert on nuclear terrorism and proliferation and power plant safety and security, Edward Lyman, joins us. He is a senior scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and we will discuss the dangerous density of spent fuel at overcrowded cooling pools in the U.S. that poses a safety risk that would dwarf the economic and social disruption caused by the Fukushima meltdowns. Then finally, once again, we'll visit the deadly intersection of mental health and easy access to automatic firearms following the latest gun massacre in Santa Barbara, and speak with Carolyn Reinick-Wolf, who is the director of the country's only mental health law practice dealing with families with members who are potential risks to society and themselves. And also joining us to discuss the culpability of the NRA and the entertainment business in arming and influencing the shooter is John Donahue, a professor of law at Stanford Law School and the author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis. And joining us now is Charles Kupchan, who was director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He is now a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. His books include Power in Transition, The Peaceful Change of International Order, How Enemies Become Friends, The Sources of Stable Peace, and No One's World, The West, The Rising Rest, and The Coming Global Turn. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Kupchan.
Glad to be with you.
And this sort of right-wing sweep in the European elections, of course, has alarmed the political establishments in most of the European countries. And it sort of is in contrast to the absolute drubbing that the right wing got in the Ukrainian elections. Of course, Russia has made a great deal about the idea that the Ukraine has been taken over by fascists and neo-Nazis. But far-right-wing parties in the Ukrainian election only got 2% of the vote. What's your sense then, just to start with Ukraine, of Petro Poroshenko's sudden move to oust the pro-Russian separatists, particularly at the airport in Donetsk?
Well, I think the election on Sunday turned out well for Ukrainians and also for the Western democracies that have been hoping to pull Ukraine in a westward direction. Not only did he win in the first round because he got more than 50%, but he won in a landslide. Yulia Tymoshenko, the former prime minister, only got about 13% of the vote. And so to the degree that this is a president with a mandate, one can begin to see the country hanging together. And that is by no means a foregone conclusion. He has been using a lot of force in the past 24 hours against separatists that took over a regional airport in the eastern part of the country. From what we can gather, the Ukrainian military has succeeded in wresting control of that airfield, and the separatists have been dealt a pretty serious blow. A lot of them have been killed. And even while he's doing that, he's reaching out to Moscow. He has been talking in the last 24 hours about getting together with Putin. He knows Putin. And so this could be a guy who was able to press the fight against the separatists and at the same time craft a reasonably good working relationship with the Kremlin.
But do you think he can that such a relationship is possible if Putin's bottom line is that the Ukraine has to accept his annexation of Crimea? And furthermore, it would seem that given the claim on the $2.5 billion that Ukraine owes Russia or Gazprom for back, the gas that they've already used, one wonders whether who's going to end up paying for that, because Ukraine's economy is in a downward spiral. Its currency has lost 30% of its value this year, and its largest trading partner is, of course, Russia.
Well, he's got his work cut out for him, as you just outlined, and he is going to be the head of a country that has been dysfunctional ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Its institutions, its economy, its politicians have never really made the transition toward a fully functional liberal democratic state with a capitalist economy. So he's got a lot of work to do. But I do think that that Crimea is not going to be a make-or-break issue. I wouldn't go so far as to say that it's off the table, but I think that given how much water is under the bridge, Poroshenko probably is not going to expend a huge amount of political capital on that issue. Instead, I think he's going to try to decentralize power, to give those eastern regions that are more pro-Russian the feeling that they have a wide berth and that the western part of the country wants to keep them in and give them the autonomy they want. And that may well satisfy Putin enough that he strikes a deal on continued supply of gas. And the IMF and the European Union have already, because they've been on the ground in Ukraine for the last few months, set up programs to get aid to Ukraine pretty quickly. Some of that aid may well go to paying off debts to Russia.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration and is now a Professor of International Affairs in Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and the author of No One's World, The West, The Rising Rest, and The Coming Global Turn. So if Europe is to bail out Ukraine and ironically, perhaps some European and U.S. Money may end up in Putin's coffers. Is there any expectation on Europe's part that since they're bailing this country out, that it would then reintroduce the EU deal that basically triggered this whole crisis?
Yes, and Poroshenko has stated as much. The outline of that deal remains to be seen, but the president-elect has indicated that he plans to proceed with political and economic deals that would attach Ukraine to Europe in a way that it's never been. But I think the trick is to do so in a way that does not appear to the Russians to be a zero-sum game. And he's talked about, for example, moving ahead with a political and economic deal with the European Union and at the same time having a free trade area with the Russians. And I think that is really the only way forward. The idea that somehow Ukraine, a country that has been attached to Russia culturally, politically, commercially, religiously, for centuries, is going to sort of turn its back and walk away, that's simply not on. That won't happen, and it would probably trigger some kind of rash action by the Russians. And so I think Poroshenko is right in trying to portray Ukraine as a country that's going to be in a geopolitical, not no man's land, but affiliate with the West at the same time that it maintains its ties to Russia.
So turning to the European elections, Charles Kupchan, in Denmark, Britain, France, and Greece, as well as Austria, Sweden, and Hungary, there were surprising gains from the far right, in particular in France. Le Pen's party came out ahead of everybody, as did Nigel Farage in the UK, which must be a huge surprise to the British establishment and in Britain in general, where the country's always been considered extremely tolerant. Lafarge is mockingly the British establishment is saying the mainstream politicians are like goldfish that have been tipped out of their bowl onto the floor and are gasping for air. So what do you make of this extraordinary populist right-wing surge in Europe?
Well, it is extraordinary, and it's worrisome. You know, for starters, the one thing that I would say off the get-go is that most of these parties are not dark 1930s kinds of populists. There are a few: the Jobbik Party in Hungary, Golden Dawn in Greece. These parties represent anti-Semitism. They are proto-fascist. They are neo-Nazis of sorts. They did gain strength, and they are dangerous. Elsewhere in Europe, what we've seen is both right-wing and left-wing populists surge. And as you said, Ian, in Britain and in France, two of the largest countries in Europe, these populist right-wing parties actually came out on top. Now, the implications of those victories are limited in the sense that these votes were for the European Parliament. These countries will send these right-wing politicians to Brussels, to the European Parliament, and that is a body that has limited power. It is more consultative than it is legislative. But what it does say is that it's possible that in a national election, one of these parties could win. It's possible that the National Front could win the French election, and you could have a president of France who represents a far-right populist, anti-immigrant, anti-EU agenda. We're not there yet. I don't think that we're going to get there, but the strength of the votes for these parties in right across Europe is quite striking, and it will create a European Parliament that has 25% to 30% of its members questioning the union itself. It would be a little bit like holding an election in the United States and having 25% of the U.S. Congress wondering whether the union was a good thing.
And, of course, the idea that the European Union is inevitable, immutable, you know, that very core belief is now shaken, isn't it?
It is. You know, I think that what's happened here is that, you know, for most of its history, the European Union, it used to be called the European Economic Community, the Common Market, kind of flew below the radar screen. It wasn't a big deal in domestic politics. Elites, day by day, pushed the baby forward, and they went from a single market and then to a single currency not too long ago, the so-called euro. And domestic electorates kind of went along for the ride. What has happened over the last decade is that people have woken up to Europe. They're talking about it in restaurants, on the street, and they're saying unkind things about it. So the European Union has been politicized, and you can't really put the genie back in the bottle. And it's a combination of immigration, unemployment, economic downturn, a union that went from 12 to 16 and now 28 members, so it lost its core identity. All of these things have led to a souring among European electorates in the sense that the European institutions and the European street aren't in sync anymore. Now, the big question is this a blip? Is this a temporary detour that is a function of the Eurozone crisis, or has the European Union hit its high water mark, and in the years ahead, it is going to either just stay where it is now or perhaps even unravel? We don't know the answer to that, but the mere fact that we are asking that question does, as you put it, shake the foundations of the European experiment.
And how much do you think the prolonged European financial crisis has led to this disquiet, if not rebellion, in Europe, given the austerity that was imposed and how much it's backfired and essentially, you know, the average European, particularly in Greece and Spain and Italy and other countries, have basically been punished because of, you know, corrupt governments and banks not doing their due diligence.
No question that the Eurozone crisis and the austerity that came with it have led to the populism, have made many Europeans say, why are we doing this? What is the point of European integration if, in fact, we're worse off and not better off? But the reality is that this turn started before the financial crisis. I think you could date it to 2005 when a referendum was held on a new European constitution, and it was rejected in both the Netherlands and in France. I see it as not just about the downturn in the economy, but as a larger reaction to globalization, to European integration, to the sense that voters have lost a certain amount of control over their destiny. And they're now saying to their politicians, we want to wrest control back. We want national borders to be national boundaries again. We want to have control over who's coming in and who's going out. And so in many respects, it's not just about European integration. It is in some ways a conflation of the penetration of the traditional nation state, both by globalization and by the strictures of the European Union.
But what didn't seem to happen in this election, and given the caveats about its importance that you've given us, Charles Kupchan, is that I don't see a reflection of any disquiet over what's happening in Russia and Ukraine, any sense of their vulnerability over Russian gas, the idea that NATO should be beefed up. That doesn't seem to be on the table.
You're right, and it's interesting. Perhaps a little bit troubling. I would have thought a couple of months ago that what the Russians have done in Ukraine would temper the populism in Europe and help Europeans rediscover the magic of the European Union, which is essentially rid Western and Central Europe of war. National boundaries don't matter anymore geopolitically, and the European Union is one of the main reasons. But the trouble in Ukraine and the bearing of the Russian teeth don't seem to have done that. And I was in Germany last week, and I have to say that I was particularly surprised by the public debate in Germany about Ukraine, a sense of much, much greater empathy and sympathy with Russia than you hear in the United States. Part of it historic, part of it guilt about the number of Russians that died in World War II, and also just hardcore interests. Germany is much more closely integrated with Russia economically in terms of gas, in terms of exports, than the United States. And as a consequence, the Germans were, I think, hopeful of getting out of this crisis without a serious breach with Russia. Given what happened in Ukraine over the weekend, these elections, the Germans may actually get what they want.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here, Charles Kupchan.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and is a Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And his latest book is No One's World, The West, The Rising Rest, and the Coming Global Turn. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the U.S. is ignoring growing risks at its nuclear power plants.